Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And this month, as we stumble into the darkness of winter,
there was some snow on the ground this morning. I think it's gone now.
The rest of England is being swathed in white, and we are just getting the occasional bit of drizzle.
Well, we're in the home counties.
That's not any guarantee. You know that perfectly well. If I find myself stuck at the bottom of the valley again, as we did one Christmas a few years back, then I'm going to be very, very grumpy about it. However, this month we're going to talk about one-offs and convention games and the peculiar constraints that you find yourself stuck in when you're stuck around a table with a group of complete strangers looking at you as if you're a respectable GM.
Yeah, I think this may be the hardest form of adventure to write / run. So, and we've both done a fair amount of it. So
we are here to share our wisdom with you, as always. It comes towards the end of the year, you may or may not have noticed, and at this season of the year, two things loom on my personal mind. One of which is a custom from my Wednesday night group of taking a whole day to play role-playing games. My Wednesday night group is regularly interrupted by Christmas festivities in their normal schedule, and so we find a day with when all of us are off work and or lounging about, and we go and have a full day's, and for that full day's gaming, it's my custom to write something totally unconnected to our current gaming, maybe calling upon previous gaming, or maybe just something entirely new.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also the time of year when I think to myself, oh God, StabCon is... Excuse me. Oh God, StabCon is coming up. I really ought to have something prepared for that. I already ought to run something this year. I've been lazy in recent years, but once again, my residual conscience is pricking me, and I'm thinking about putting something together for a 3-hour session at StabCon. And this happily coincides with a suggestion that Roger has come up with from via a friend of ours.
Yes, valued listener Shimin Beg has suggested we don't think we've actually. Well, he doesn't think we've actually talked about one shots and convention games in general and how one writes them.
I've got the vague feeling we have talked about this, but I am willing to
give it again.
Right, fresh run up. Wipe your mind of all. Yeah, no, nothing is lingering in detail in the memory. So that's fine. I can't remember doing it before. I just have this vague conviction.
Well, so... I do confess to a slight history on this because I wrote an article on how to design convention scenarios specifically for The Last Province, issue number 1.
Oh, God, that was a long time ago.
Yes, back in the day, there were role-playing magazines.
Yes, and they came out almost every month for almost... 6 months at a time, sometimes. I think the paper pyramid, which ran to 30 issues, was the longest running one that I've, apart from White Dwarf, which back in the day, you know.
So, yeah, paper pyramid was Steve Jackson Games' thing, and it certainly promoted GURPS, but it had articles for all sorts of other games as well. And when I say role-playing magazines, I am talking about... general purpose, not here is a support thing for our specific game, which has lasted rather longer. I think they're all gone now because they're all online, but anyway. But The Last Province was not supported by a game company. It wasn't as a marketing exercise. EAT and many of the others, I think, sprang up in response to White Dwarf shifting from we will cover a bit of everything but a lot of Games Workshop to we are now a Games Workshop marketing tool.
And we're just doing Games Workshop's biggest stuff.
I know a lot of people abandoned it just then, and many of them went off to start magazines of their own. The Last Province lasted 5 issues, but anyway.
The Arcane was the last big one, which I think was a which I think was a publisher inspired thing. It certainly did a lot of good stuff while it lasted, but I think the economics eventually bore down upon it.
But anyway, this is all digression. The point is that was late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, about then.
So I've been at least thinking about this since then. Specifically, I have, for it's closed down now, but the reason I got into demonstrating for Steve Jackson Games and the Men in Black was that I was already running convention scenarios of GURPS at various conventions. And that way they would pay me to do it.
This is indeed a benign and far-sighted program, which is now folded, as you say. But, all right, so the two one-offs and conventions are slightly different things, but they certainly have things in common.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about two things, which I think are the key guidelines I want to do for this. First is focus, and the second is simplification. By focus, I think I mean deciding just what you want to do with this scenario, the thing you want to teach, celebrate, show off, enjoy, even. I mean, I've run convention scenarios of things like Everway, just because I thought to myself, it's been a long time since I've done this system, which I enjoy.
Yeah, my nominal objective, writing a GURPS scenario to run at, for example, UK Games Expo, was at least in part show people who haven't played GURPS how GURPS works, and you know maybe encourage them to think I could do this too.
Yeah, I did that once at a Worldcon, London Worldcon, and I managed to I had one Virgin player, and I managed to canoodle a copy of one of the GURPS core books, and gave, I think Steve Jackson Gaines was being absent-mindedly generous, and I gave it to him as a prize at the end of the session, which is the sort of thing you dream about doing.
So anyway. There's also the slightly related thing. Those of you who have the extreme good taste to listen to Watson Hall actual play recordings will know that we often go for a relatively short, maybe a single adventure or two adventures, rather than a long campaign. And one of the things we do with that is to try new systems. So in that case, unlike the convention game, these are people I know, but we're also seeing one of us has found this system and feels enthusiastic about it. We want the rest of us to decide, is this going to be something that works for us? Do we ought to play it again some more, maybe?
Yeah.
So as you say, it's not the same set of objectives, but it's quite a similar one.
I think in almost any convention game, given that you are going to have the problem of you don't know who is going to turn up nor with what motives, you have to be prepared to teach the game up to a point, which is going to limit the things that you can do. I have a range of games that I can run, and I know well enough that I can explain to people and wing it with those games. But I think there are things out there that I would not dream of daring to try to introduce to somebody who's just turned up and I don't know anything about their experience. And I don't know. I would never try Eclipse Phase, mind you. I've never run Eclipse Phase with people I do know and I've got plenty of time with. But
example. Are we perhaps overloading the term game here? Because there are two separate aspects to that. One of them is how quickly can you teach the system? And I can teach GURPS in under 2 minutes to the point where somebody can look at a pre-gen character and work out how to play it. Because this is a thing that I have said many times. The hard work in GURPS is learning how to pick things to go on your character sheet.
Yeah,
it is not in using them once they've got there. A thing I was doing towards the end of my Men in Black run, in fact, was for each of the disadvantages on a character sheet, I would put in the relevant paragraph from the rulebook in the notes, because to me, looking at the disadvantages is how you find out who this character is. We assume that they are generically heroic in some respect, but what are the things in which they're going to fail to do that? And the disads are, in GURPS terms, are a very easy way of getting to know these are the things you're going to be bad at, separate from the things you just don't have particularly have skills in. So there's that. But there's also the setting.
Yeah.
And the setting, I think, has to be very accessible. Similarly. Because...
Yeah.
And, all right, the great Phil Masters has run Transhuman Space Convention scenarios, and he has carefully picked bits of the setting that are quick to introduce. And he's very good at that. I have run a bunch of things, but generally I have run in something fairly generic or something I know will be familiar to the players. For example, the other set of convention scenarios I've written is for Convocation, the yogsothoth.com conventions, and those are, well, you know, everybody knows what Cthulhoid Investigation looks like. I tell them this is a 1920s game or this is a 1980s game, and they know roughly what to expect.
Anybody with any experience, again, you do have the...
The YSDC events are open to site members, but you have to be a site member to find out about them. Yeah. So they're not going to have random members of the public wandering in.
But in, under most convention circumstances, you may... at least, at the very least, you may have people who look at your sign-up sheet and say, I've always wanted to play that game. This is my big chance.
And as we've said, that's one of the things that this game is for.
I think we can say that when you're writing a scenario for a convention game, you want to lean in heavily on the tropes, and you want to go for a classic setting, maybe with a small twist, but there's a strong limit on the number of twists you can put into a convention game. There's only so much time in a 3-hour slot. Let's assume we're going for a 3-hour slot. There's only so much time for introduction.
Traditionally, it's 4, but maybe times have changed.
Maybe it's me being lazy. But even 4 hours is going to... You've got... Introducing the characters to each other. A first initial involving scene to get them together. And then into the mid-flow and... There's only so much aha and surprise that you can pull in a limited time.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen advice for Dungeons & Dragons writers for this sort of scenario that mark out the time very, very distinctly, you know, half an hour for getting everybody together and getting the character sheets handed out and so on, half an hour per encounter, where an encounter could be typically a fight, but also, you know, a complicated NPC you have to argue, or a complicated trap, or whatever. And then half an hour for cleanup at the end. So you have your 6 encounters, and that is what you are going to have. Which seems too dirigiste for me, but I tend to run games which are a bit more freeform in structure, and particularly investigative games.
I think there's a strong case here for starting the actual gameplay in media res with a team together doing its thing and nearly at the end of defeating some foe or accomplishing some mission, and then using that as the intro into the main story.
Mm. I'm a fan of the teaser, but I haven't managed to make it work yet. I could very easily see a survival horror game, for example, if it's sufficiently simple, where you hand out the character sheets for the people who are going to get killed by the monsters. Have a 5-minute you get killed by the monsters. And then the monster hunting team turns up and these are your real characters. Something like that.
Yes. I'm not sure how you advertise that. Come along to the bait and switch.
Well, yeah, it would have to be advertised as a monster hunting game, and then you say, well, yeah, this is the bit that happens first. But that's also a way of, if you've got somebody who isn't familiar with the system, they can work out what some of their options are without having to worry too much about keeping their character alive.
doesn't it rather tell you what the monster is right from the start and impede on the investigation game?
Okay, maybe I'm just thinking of when Doctor Who does horror, it does a very good job of not showing you what the monster is other than it's got claws.
Yes, but they're playing characters who are being killed by the monster with his claws, and I think that would give their next incarnations a tiny clue.
Mm.
All right. What was I going to say? We've already passed over the first point on my simplify agenda, which is pre-gen characters.
Yeah, unless it's a very... Well, I don't think this has ever happened to me, but I know you've run games in which building the characters and indeed the setting is part of the point.
Yeah, I have had... I think the first time this happened to me was when I got signed up to an Apocalypse World demo game at... I can't remember. It might have been Dragon Meter, it might have been something else in London. And I was delighted to find this new system of creating characters on this pre-filled out, but with lots of options, player sheet.
Mm.
And that was part of the point of it. And I think Powered by the Apocalypse sometimes can allow you to do that at the table and just get it all done.
I think it would be fair to argue that Powered by the Apocalypse, in general, the Apocalypse World system, I should say, is very good for this sort of thing because whatever the setting, you will have the eight stereotyped sorts of character that can be in it.
Yeah.
And you can hand these out and people can tick their boxes and they're ready to go and it's still their character to some extent. I mean, it doesn't have the mechanical depth that I personally like, but you know, that side of it can work. Also, the fact that the game has a strict time limit because when you get enough advances, the campaign is essentially over. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, quite. But something like GURPS, as you say, the main effort is always going to be going into the creating the character, and you should have everything you need on the character sheet to be able to run the character, understand the character, and just generally get into the game very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked before about players not reading briefings. The character sheet is to some extent a briefing.
Yeah, I think. Here's something I got off a recent episode of Ludonarrative Dissidence, in which those three worthies were analysing a introductory scenario for the Alien role-playing game. And their problem was that they found, one of their criticisms, was they found there had been too much built into the background of the characters. Aliens is a game designed for at least one member of the team to betray all the others at every session, because one of you has got to play the company man. And there had been a lot of A hates B, but trusts C, C hates B, but trusts A, and all that sort of thing built into the background, which I don't think, and they didn't think, most people could pick up sufficiently to make it worthwhile. And it would absorb a hell of a lot of time that you don't generally have in a convention game.
I think it's a setting that calls for it. I know groups that just really don't get on with interplayer conflict. And it can come to the level of casually tossing insults at each other, but it should not affect the actual game beyond that.
Well, I think...
Not every group, not every player is like that, but ones who are will not be happy with that situation.
Yeah, what I was thinking was it's a pick-up game with people, most of whom will never have met each other before.
Mm.
You have to assume that as the default. And it's going to be hard enough getting them to work together. And getting them to do meaningful fighting together is going to be even harder and absorb more time which isn't going towards the actual adventure. Maybe.
Well, arguably it is part of the adventure. I mean, let's face it, there are really only two scenarios in the Alien universe. And they're basically Alien 1 and Alien 2. So, you know, I know there are people who say they run campaigns of this, but I don't know how. Because my experience is, even within the space of one scenario, it starts to get a bit samey, because, you know, okay, the spaceship is infested, we've got to try to escape. How long can you drag that out for?
Right. I would say that you need... each character needs a focus for opportunities to role play. And I would say you want to keep those light and maybe one to a character. Some sort of personality trait or some sort of secret advantage which they can bring out at the right moment and will enhance the adventure.
Well,
I don't think you need a list of them.
Well, yeah, a thing that's working on the GM/author's side here is you can design the characters specifically to fit with this adventure, not just in terms of the useful skills, but in terms of, okay, I've got an idea that at some point there will be this particular psychological stressor. Let us put in a PC who is going to break under that. That kind of thing.
Yeah, or at least be tested. Somebody who is going to cause himself or his comrades trouble somewhere down the line.
And again, there's a trust consideration here. This is one of the reasons, in fact, why I would not now run a convention game without an X card or similar, simply because some of those players, even now, are going to be used to adversarial GMing, and, you know, we must play perfectly in order not to get killed. And I would much... The sort of game I want to run, and there isn't an easy way to explain this to people who don't already understand the concept, is I want you to play your characters and have fun doing it, and if that means they screw up sometimes, well, that's fine. I'm not going to kill you for it. Not always, anyway. One flip side of designing the characters for the scenario, though, do not give one PC the specialised knowledge that they will need to proceed, because you can be absolutely sure that will be the PC who is not played.
You should be able to. There should always be some way through.
But also if you're going to say, all right, I can take up to six players, but I will run with a minimum of three, let us say, then any combination of three characters should be able to do it, which seems obvious, but it's a thing one needs to think of.
I was thinking just a moment ago, perhaps because you've got me reading that dreadful thing, Assistant to the Villain, there might be a good use for melodramatic reveals of characters' personal secrets in a convention game, when the lost cousin or father or what have you turns up in the middle of it, and one player character who has to be the one who's played can reveal the dread secret. I think that might. Have fun in it.
Well, yeah, I mean, in one respect, one can take off the brakes because we don't have to worry about how these characters are playable next.
No, there is no long term in one-offs. Not normally, anyway.
I think I've mentioned in the World War II campaign, towards the end, one of the characters became widely known as the man who duelled Hirohito.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, every media organisation operating in Japan had a camera there. He is not going to be able to be much of a covert agent hereafter. That's fine, because it was the end of the campaign.
Yeah. But what sort of scale do you think one ought to go for in a one-off? I mean, I've run things which were street-level fantasy games, and I've run things like Everway, in which mythologies were shaken and the fate of worlds were decided in one 4-hour session. So what do you think works best? Is there a distinction, or do you just play to the game's strengths?
Well, I think I can duck and dodge a bit and say that what the level you feel comfortable with, and for me that tends to be more towards the street level.
Yeah.
I'm much more interested in people's personal reactions rather than. Well, I mean, no, that's not fair. That can come up to big to high levels as well. You know, you can have the grand moment of temptation. Are you going to rule the empire or overthrow it? That kind of thing. But
yeah.
I think I like to start relatively small because it's easier for the players to relate to.
Yeah.
I mean, fairly small can be, you know, you're a James Bond level super agent, but you are basically a normal person with great skills rather than a superhero. That's my taste. If you want to run up to high power level after that, then it means you have to run up pretty quickly, which is possible, but I think, again, it's just yet another thing you need to bear in mind that, yes, I want to be escalating from, you know, I was taking a dossier from some dodgy foreign country to, and this is their plan to nuke the world and blame it on somebody else.
I think I am feeling the temptation to run Knights Black Agents for my day off, but I'm not sure how they'll take it. Writing something for people you know is a lot more difficult than writing something for faceless strangers in many ways. When there are people you know, you have to. Play to their known enthusiasms and strengths, as well as accounting for their weaknesses. But within a convention game, all you can do is be honest in the call sheet, the advert for the game, and allow for people to X card out when things get unpleasant or sticky for them.
Yeah. And I do not feel that horror needs gore to be horrifying, but some people do, and yeah, that is fine for their games.
I have a slightly casual attitude towards gore, it must be said. All right. Okay, so
I would say that you started with focus. I started thinking about this with time. You have a hard time constraint, and it is unsatisfying if you get to the end of your... If people have to leave and you say, well, okay, we're nearly at the end, but not quite. Yeah. So, you can't really afford players to faff very much. And B, you want to get where you're going. And I think a certain amount of railroadiness is entirely acceptable here.
I think it's almost inevitable. But... I will not say the best thing is a node approach. You get to that node in the story, and then they can go this way or that way, or they can go some other way that they've got into their tiny minds.
Yes, but I would say also modular.
Yeah,
I've only written this out formally once, but say your theoretical path of things is A to J, and you've got to D and you realise you're coming up in the end. Well, there should be a way of skipping ahead to the last few scenes transparently to the players. They shouldn't even be aware that it's happening. But so therefore, I think I would say overwrite and underrun.
Yeah,
write much more than you're going to need. And then be prepared to cut ruthlessly if the players don't get through it all in time. And even, you know, plan for them not to get through it all in time. Maybe they've really enjoyed this thing and not so much enjoyed that thing. So I will use that this module that's a bit like the thing they enjoyed rather than the other one.
You can always drop when they're following a trail of clues or, you know, breadcrumbs. You can always drop a breadcrumb from a later scene into the one that you've just completed, having looked at the clock and deciding 1 hour to go, I've got to get this going faster.
Mm.
You can always pull or create a new clue to the pointing at the climactic scene that you've got written. I'm not saying that any of these scenes ought to be terribly complex or detailed. You just need a location, an encounter, whether it's the aged librarian with a gleam in his eye, who turns out to be the high priest of the evil cult, of course, or it's a tentacle wielding monster, or it's an encounter with the local landlord or lord.
It's connectivity.
You just need to have an outline, and you can cut it and paste it and improvise it to the players.
Yeah, and if a particular scene is clearly being fun for everybody, then yeah, absolutely, build it out, enhance what you're doing there. I think connections are the key thing, though. So, you know, my theoretical connection might go C to D, but I will also try to sneak in a way of saying, okay, if things are running slow, here's where you can shortcut forward to G. But here is, you know, this is just a different clue you can find in C that will point to the other place, but still fits into C without being obviously, oh well, let's skip over some stuff.
Yeah, you want to present the impression that this is what you meant to do all along, but that's a general good rule for GMing.
We've talked before about the campaign pitch, and I think some of that applies here. If you're able to say you are X who do Y in world/location Z, that's a really good way of getting things started. Because in the convention scenario situation, players are not perhaps at their brightest and perkiest. Sometimes they are, but you know, sometimes they're not. Giving some sort of handle where they can say, "Okay, this is cinematic spies. I know this. This is 1920s Lovecraftian investigators. I understand how this works."
Uh-huh.
And I would be inclined not to betray that too much, because that is just that easy way of saying, "Okay, You've done this kind of thing before. It's not going to be exactly the same thing, but to start with, let's get into this, and you know how it works, and you get the hang of your character, get the hang of the system."
Now, hang on, let me dig up from my computer some of the sheets I have used. Okay, I think the one which says, "Illustrious GM and noted podcaster Michael Kuehl returns to StabCon with an adventure for Everway." Now, that worked. This is the generic Everway sheet, and I just give the title of the thing. Generic monster of the week. Yeah, that's much of the same. Let me see now. Full of magic. Magic is dying. And so is the last Magus. With a small group of companions, the Magus is going on a journey. Fall of Magic is the storytelling game of that journey. Michael Kuehl, famed podcaster and generally all-round good chap, is telling the story. Join him in telling the story. I may have a bit of an ego problem.
To be fair, when I'm looking through convention game listings, I do like to know who the GM is, as well as what the system is.
There
are certain people whose games I will actively try to join, even if it sounds like something completely irrelevant to my interests, because I know it will be a good game.
Yeah, I can't read some of this stuff, especially not the Dungeon World one, because it displays my ego a little too openly.
Well, I played the Dungeon World thing you ran at StabCon. I enjoyed it. Yeah. So.
Oh, hang on. All right, that Dungeon World, a new old fashioned. This is the first time I ever ran Dungeon World. Dungeon World, a new old fashioned game involving bold adventurers delving deep into monster infested holes in the ground to do great deeds, slaughter hideous monsters, and defeat big bad villains. Maybe to pick up bits of treasure, none of it magical. Some of it magical that have been left carelessly lying around. For the first time at any gaming table, Michael Kuehl, gaming dinosaur, second class, will give this game a try. Hey. And perhaps in a perhaps futile middle-aged attempt to return to the roots of the hobby and regain his lost innocence, youth, and enthusiasm. Dear me, I do talk about myself entirely.
My dear, we have both run Dungeon Bash games since then, so...
Well, true, and they are fun. But yeah, give them some enthusiasm and something... What I prefer to do sometimes is to just write about the situation. You are a group of schoolboys going home for the Christmas holidays in the late 19th century, and the snow has begun falling. That was a perfectly good tie into a Doctor Who based game that I ran at StabCon, and if you describe the situation and who the players are, as you say, this is a world, this is who you are. I think it's a pretty good grab for getting people to sign up most times.
Though another thing I think we may have mentioned before, there are some things that will just put people off, and I don't know what they are, except that one of them seems to be GURPS. I ran the same scenario at a few different conventions, and sometimes I said using what was it? The Cthulhu hack, which I think was the version you played in, and sometimes I said running GURPS, and when I said running GURPS, I just didn't get the sign-ups. Same blurb in every other respect.
It has a formidable reputation, which it does not really deserve. I would say that it's quite difficult to get people up to speed with most role playing character sheets. The sheets for GURPS and for current RuneQuest are both very complicated looking, and both involve straining your eyesight and it's not always clear where things are. And I sometimes find that things like what's it called, Quest Worlds nowadays, or Rhesus, or something that's bold and simple, and you can get all the cliches and all the description of the character on one side of a sheet and into a few values.
I think we've said before, maybe even last episode, embrace the cliche.
Yeah, you've got to give a lot of shorthand to the players. It's the 1930s. You are a noble white hunter, and the fact that there might be embarrassing things about imperialism lurking in the background of the game isn't what you need to know going in. You need to know, I am being a white hunter, or I am being a British spy in this scenario. So you need to know a feel for the genre. And if the GM's going to subvert it, then let it be in a very small sort of way. People will delight in small subversions, as long as it doesn't spoil their sense of the fun of what's to be found in a particular genre.
Yeah, I mean, particularly if you're taking older literature, and it's very easy to end up saying, "Well, hang on, this entire setup is rotten," and this may well be a valid thing to say in literary criticism, but it's not a valid thing to do in the game, because people are playing the game because they enjoy that genre.
Yeah,
they may well be just as aware of its faults as you are, but they're here to have fun.
I don't think you need to forgive anything, but I think you can emphasise the whole thing. Mind you, around the world in 80 days, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, if that's what it's called, both managed to get digs in to the imperialism of the British Empire. Mind you, they were written by French persons.
Yeah, 20,000 Leagues has a different version, because at least in some versions, like the some translations, the local market didn't want to be seen to be promoting anti-British stuff, because Nemo is an Indian prince in at least some versions, whose family was killed by the British.
Yeah.
But in some translations, that is not the case. So.
Oh, dear me. How very 19th century politically correct.
Obviously. Yeah, well, also in the films, obviously.
Yeah, the latest one has him as a Sikh freedom fighter who steals the Nautilus, which I felt rather diminished his
Some of it is agency. Look at this thing I built is a key part of it to me, mind you. I won't talk about it at length, but you, listeners may be amused to look up the story of the Fenian Ram. If you are planning to steal a submarine, have somebody on your theft team who knows how to drive a submarine. May seem obvious.
It does, somewhat. All right, so we've talked about limiting the controlling the path of the scenario, controlling how complicated playing the characters is going to be. What else have we missed that we can simplify?
Well, going in a slightly different direction, playtest lots.
Excuse me. I don't think I can repeat. The most I'm going to get a playtest out of what I'm going to write over the next, or adapt or just use over the next few weeks, is showing it to my Wednesday night group in a long session at the weekend after Christmas. And then maybe using it at StabCon again if it works well.
Yeah, when I'm going for relatively short things, I try to do them both with Warts and All and with the Wednesday night group, who are very forgiving on these matters.
Well, you may get the chance to rerun things time and again. I have more curiosity about what I can do next than I have about perfecting the things I've already done. But perhaps I should take a lesson from your book.
Well, for a while I had it working as a reasonably reliable conveyor. I would debut a new scenario at Convocation, or Yogg-Sothoth Games Day as it used to be, and that would be the third run, having done it previously with the groups of people I know. And then for the next Games Expo, so that would be in October-ish time, for the next Games Expo in June, I would have it... all corrected after that first public run, and then I'll be running it with complete strangers at Expo, and that worked quite well. Problem, of course, being that Games Expo in particular has this tendency to put three games in a small room, and two of them are loud D&D, and the other one is your attempted atmospheric game, and it doesn't work terribly well.
Yeah.
So I stopped doing that.
Well, the small space at StabCon has been reserved, so if I do anything for StabCon, he's going to be shouting with two other games in the background. But
well, at least the rooms are a bit bigger. Yeah.
True, you're not right up against each other, but you are definitely within earshot. Those large, echoey Masonic rooms cause some difficulty in hearing anything even across your own table. But still,
thing I've often said. Look, we've got this great big table. Could you lot come a bit nearer?
Talking about table, I'd say that if any point is one at which you want to have pre-prepared visuals and pre-prepared maps, then a convention game should be it.
Yeah.
You should be able to show them. See, this is what you're looking at. Whether it's the monsters or the location, and it's definitely a help to have an explorable map on the table when it comes to dungeon crawls and what have you.
Also, it has been said that the Platonic form of the Cthulhu scenario is a set of handouts with incidental linking material, and I believe the Armitage Files actually tried to put that into practice, but. A thing that I have found useful, and if you're doing an XR, you already have the bits for it, is simply some way of letting every player put up a thing in front of them with their character name on it, big enough for the other players to read.
Yes, definitely.
You can even make these in advance.
You really should. I mean, my players for my Wednesday night game have a tendency to put out their their character names and their any combat stats that the GM really ought to know, like their base speed in GURPS, so that I can remember who they are, because I have a terrible memory for names, and I can remember what order they go in. And that should be something, if you're pre-preparing characters, that should be something that's on the character sheet, as on the character card in front of them. I'm not sure quite how you deal with hidden disadvantages, but I should be able to remember them, the character sheets, but I don't always.
Well, a thing I wrote some years ago, and I still use when I'm running GURPS, it's a bit of software that will take a set of character files from GURPS Character Assistant, which is the standard way of generating and editing GURPS characters, and sort them into order by action speed, which is basic speed, tie broken by dex, I think, tie broken by something else which I've forgotten. But it basically, what I get is a few pages that are one column per character. And the first few rows are their stats, strength, dex, so on, and then, you know, hit points, willpower, perception, things like that. And then it will run down into the skills. And so if say, okay, here is an administration type task. Well, that these two characters are the people who actually have that skill and are good at it. So I will ask them to make rolls, that kind of thing.
You have reinvented and mechanized the squad sheet.
Yes, I'm guessing from just working out from the name. In my case, that is an automated thing, and I've never quite understood why this wasn't made part of GURPS Character Assistant. I mean, there is a thing called the GM control sheet that's built into it, but it didn't quite do this. But for disadvantages, it gets more complex. What I ended up was doing it. At the end of this, just dumping a paragraph for each character of here are their disadvantages and advantages and so on.
Actually, you could. The thought occurs to me: you could put cryptic icons onto the card in front of the player, which only the GM knows the meaning of, at least at the start of the game. that might be amusing. Yeah. How much when you look at your one-off scenario prep, how much work would it take to make it publishable, make it usable by somebody else? Because in my case, eons worth of work.
Well, I tend to write very light. It's possible to overwrite, because what I want in front of me is three or four pages at most, in which I can look for stuff. And therefore, most of what I actually have on those three or four pages are things that will trigger a memory in me, rather than here in detail is how to run it. And then some stat blocks, if I'm going to need stat blocks. I am fortunate because Shimin Beg, who indeed suggested this topic, has taken a couple of my rough notes and fleshed them out. And at some point, and frankly, this is dependent on finding the right technology, that I am planning to drop some of these onto DriveThruRPG in some form. You will hear about it here, because I will be crowing about it and saying, please buy my stuff.
Yeah, well, I've just boosted my ego shamelessly through our listeners' ears, so I think I can forgive you that. But, what I write is notes for me. And it will often be in my regular weekly games, it will be an incomprehensible scrawl describing the setup of a scene. When I bother to type things out, which I will do for the Christmas one-off, it will still be incomprehensible to anybody else, but more legible. It might just be here's where they meet the old woman, here's where they see the thing slinking about in the swamp. It's just enough to trigger my memory of what I've got planned, and it's not really enough to make into something anybody else can use. And, I'll not say it's impossible, but I'd have to be the one to do it.
Yeah, particularly for minor characters. I have a few stock minor characters whom I use a lot. Like the enlisted man whose first line is usually, "I didn't sign for it, Sergeant."
Yeah, gruff sergeants are a speciality, especially looking sarcastically at the back of the overprivileged lieutenant.
Very dangerous battlefield, so you never know where the next shot might come from, sir.
There was some debate in my game last night about whether I meant it literally when the sergeant said, "The lieutenant lost his head, sir."
Ever since
then, he was found bleeding, full of holes from the sturges, but it managed to make a full recovery.
Ever since the incident with the grenade, there's a little bit of the Sarge in all of us.
Yeah,
but but yeah, that is a thing that needs to be fleshed out. And if I were getting serious about this, and this is on my checklist for things to do when I am getting serious about it, one of the things I would want to do is take a scenario that I have written and run and fine-tuned and whatever, get it to the stage of written up, and then give it to somebody else and say, "Please run this for your group who do not know me."
That would be and should be a stage before publication of anything, whether it's been run by you before. Yeah, you've got to throw it at the wall and see if other people can make sense of it.
Because apart from anything else, there are going to be some shortcuts that I have forgotten about, and I have written, I don't know, something relatively non-obvious, but it's a memory trigger for me, and it's not necessarily a memory trigger for you.
Yeah, I write up some of my stuff, as you know, for Alarms and Excursions. And I often find, even when I think I have given a full description about what was going on, people reading those write-ups say, "Hang on, what was happening here? How did the starship manage to land inside the warehouse? Oh, it opened up like that, did it?" But yeah, you have to test it against other people's comprehension skills. At least once.
For that, there's a thing I've been doing for a few years, one way and another, some player's job, and this could be the GM, is to write up the events of the session reasonably promptly after it's done. I mean, within a day or two. While the memories are still relatively fresh, and publish that so that the other players can see it, and the players can then say, "Yes, but that's not how I remember it. I think it was like this." And then you can try to work out some sort of consensus, but also B, once the players have approved it, that is the Pravda. That is what really happened, even if it's not what really happened.
Yeah.
But you can go back and look at it.
I am trying to do that with the Glorantha game I'm running with you and some others. But that's the first time I've managed to do that sort of thing and be clear about what was going on a few days after the whole thing. Normally my write-ups take months. I'm writing up stuff from last year.
For what it's worth, I have done this with a recording, and I find that I get less accurate because I focus on the tiny little details of the recording rather than on the overall feel of what's happening. That may be just a me thing. But.
Well, I think there is a difference between, you know, writing it up in full detail and writing it up as an executive summary, which I think is what you're asking for. You're asking for this happened and then this happened and this happened.
And I generally don't need a blow-by-blow account of a fight, for example. But if somebody does something particularly important in a fight, whether that's, you know, maybe it's the one shot that takes out the bad guy way before he was expecting it, or that sort of thing, that is still worth writing in. But broadly, they have a fight and win. Doesn't need more detail than that, to my mind.
They have a fight, and Jeremy's character dies horribly.
Hmm.
But fights are terribly tedious to describe. And I generally skip over them when doing doing full write-ups of the games. Because the things that are interesting and fun are the character interactions there and the planning and the mistakes they make and the things that surprise them are interesting. But who shot who generally is.
I find myself increasingly tempted to build or adapt a system where fighting is just, okay, you roll your fight skill, they roll their fight skill, the side who succeeded on more wins. The way you do everything else in the game.
Yeah, but I'm not saying fighting isn't fun. I think fighting as a on-table thing can be enormous fun. But I don't think it's fun to read about. I think that sometimes the fight, whether it's small or large, whether it's on the way or a boss fight, is heart poundingly exciting. But it's not exciting to read about.
Mm.
Is my point.
Well, it's, yeah, this is I think a thing we may have mentioned before, that one reason embracing the cliche can be a good thing is that. If I'm reading a cliched book, well, you know, I've read this story before with different characters. It's, yeah, blah. If I'm doing it myself, if I'm participating in some way, that makes it more fun. Even if what we end up doing is sticking with the cliche, it is more fun because I'm making decisions in it.
Yeah.
Which to me is why the campaign write-up is rarely good literature, though it can inspire good literature.
Okay, I think we've come round.
Just one last thing.
Okay, go on.
Which we've sort of mentioned in passing. Because you are setting it to a conclusion, make the climax big.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
However, whatever big means in your particular setting and that particular adventure. But
They've come all this way. They deserve something spectacular.
Even
if it's a spectacular failure,
yeah,
it needs to be big.
Not only let them be heroic, but let them go away thinking, yeah, yeah, that was good.
Yeah. Give the paying customers what they came for, even if they're not paying. All right, I think that kind of brings us to the end of this survey of the art. And maybe we'll tell you about the ones we wrote or the ones that got away in a later occasion. If you want to tell us about your triumphs at the convention gaming table, or your tricks and techniques that made your one-offs and convention runs glow with creativity, then you can contact us via...
Email podcast@tekeli.lee or leave a message on the website.
And we'll speak to you again next month, when it will probably be even colder than it is this month.